How does summer in Seattle sound? Each summer, Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture sponsors two intensive 9-day seminars. Our next session is from July 8th to the 16th in Seattle at the height of the most beautiful time of the year in the Pacific Northwest, when you can study the mystery of nature while enjoying its splendor as well. You can apply now for our intensive 9-day seminar on intelligent design at discovery.org. The CSC Seminar in Intelligent Design in the Natural Sciences will prepare students to make research contributions advancing the growing science of intelligent design. The seminar explores cutting-edge ID work in fields such as molecular biology, embryology, developmental biology, computational biology, ID theoretic mathematics, cosmology, physics, and the history and philosophy of science. The C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society will explore the growing impact of science on politics, economics, social policy, bioethics, theology, and the arts during the past century. Sponsored by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, these are amazing opportunities intended primarily for upper division undergraduates and graduate students, plus a select group of professors, scientists, teachers, pastors, and other professionals. If you're not a candidate for this program yourself, but know students who might be, please help us by referring students here, encouraging them to apply as soon as possible. They can get more information at discovery.org. That's discovery.org. Thank you, and now back to ID the Future.
This is Todd Butterfield for ID the Future. Today we have the pleasure of chatting with Dr. Anne Gager. She's a senior research scientist at Biologic Institute, where they say, the more we learn about life, the more clearly it reveals design. And her work uses molecular genetics and genomic engineering to study the origin, organization, and operation of metabolic, that is, how a living organism functions, that is, metabolic pathways. And she received a BS in biology from MIT and a PhD in developmental biology from the University of Washington, where she studied cell adhesion molecules involved in Drosophila embryogenesis. Or, correct me if I'm wrong, but is this basically the embryo development of a fruit fly?
Yes. That's correct.
Okay. And as a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, she cloned and characterized the Drosophila kinesin, or fruit fly protein, light chain. Her research has been published in Nature, Development, and the Journal of Biological Chemistry. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gager.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, I'm glad you were able to get together with me. Today, we're going to talk about your observations on Darwin Day 2016, but first, a quick comment. As I read what you have published online, such as the article titled, Is Evolution Random? Answering a Common Challenge, I just want to let the listener know that your writing is eminently readable and understandable and just easy to get into, but at the same time, it hits the intellectual mark very well. That's exciting to me. Very engaging from the start, and I encourage anyone to search for your articles.
Well, I try to be as clear as possible and sometimes even funny.
Well, you are. I note just a sense of levity in just your general approach, and I like that. So, Dr. Gager, you recently wrote on CNSnews.com about Darwin's Day as an occasion to reflect on other people's thoughts about unintelligent design. First, what is Darwin's Day?
It's the day that Darwin was born. In some people's minds, it's replaced President's Day.
Okay.
It happens every year. Evolutionary biologists and evolutionary advocates like to get together and celebrate it.
So you don't necessarily celebrate it, but maybe you take the occasion on his birthday to highlight the flaws in Darwin's theory?
We do poke holes in it as much as we can.
Okay. So recently, in honor of Darwin's Day, you made a link between a professor, Dr. David Barash, and unintelligent design. You said that Dr. Barash, as one of Darwin's more aggressive followers, annually tells his students, as his own writing has mentioned in the New York Times, that Darwinian theory is contrary to a benevolent creator. Is that an accurate description of what you think he was saying?
Well, in the talk that he gives to his students every year, he not only says that it's contrary to a benevolent creator, but he also says that evolution is true and you might as well get over it if you want to be intellectually rigorous, then you're going to have to rethink your position on religion.
Have you heard, by the way, with such a strong statement that he would make to his students, that he has dismissed them from his class if they chose not to go his direction?
No, I don't think so from my reading of what he said about his talk.
Okay, so at least he's making a stance and encouraging others to be intellectually rigorous by going his direction.
Yeah.
We'll break down more of what his writings have said and in your article in a minute. Would you say his annual talks, you kind of allude to this a little bit, are beneficial or positive in some way to the intelligent design movement?
Absolutely not.
Well, there's only one thing that you kind of hinted, that the fact that he is out there and advertising what he does with his students rather than hiding his belief system, that makes it a little more obvious for someone like you to, well, challenge him or take him on, or at least point out that this is what's happening, because others may be the same as him, but aren't as overt.
That's correct.
But I guess that's a pretty small benefit.
Yeah. At least the students know where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Well, he goes on in the Wall Street Journal to challenge intelligent design theorists in this: the human body doesn't work so well, thus it's unintelligent. Would you mind constructing his argument and then maybe reconstructing or deconstructing it from your point of view?
Well, I first should say that in this article, he's reviewing two books, one called The Incredible Unlikeliness of Being by Alice Roberts, and the other, The Body by Darwin by Jeremy Taylor.
Hmm.
His argument is that there are so many things wrong with us, things that happen to our bodies over time, that it's evidence of unintelligent design, that we are actually not designed, we're evolved, because an intelligent designer wouldn't do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
The implication there is that an intelligent designer should design things perfectly. My take on that particular point is, how does he know what an intelligent designer would do?
Right.
And isn't that a statement of theology rather than a statement of science?
Mm-hmm.
So to proceed with his argument, he gives a lot of examples from the book and from his own thinking that illustrate why we are imperfectly designed, as he would put it. First off, he talks about the retina and it being designed backwards. And then he talks about the prostate gland being improperly designed and causing prostate problems.
Hmm.
He talks about the fact that babies' heads are sometimes bigger than their mother's pelvises, and it causes painful and sometimes dangerous birth.
Okay.
He talks about why we get cancer because of a gene present in women that makes us vulnerable to it. He talks about the fact that we share genes with a fruit fly, which I happen to know is true.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we not have tails? Then some of the things I found most interesting is that he talks about that we have large brains that are metabolically expensive, and yet we have short intestines. Why is that?
Okay.
Why do most animals that we're familiar with have heads at the front of them? These are things that there's some design answers for, as well as evolutionary answers. So you get the idea that he's trying to say what's wrong with us.
Mm-hmm.
We have so many flaws that if we were designed perfectly, we wouldn't have them. Why do we get heart attacks? Why do we have allergies? Why do we have an appendix? So let me go through and give my general response to his argument.
Please
I've already indicated that the argument from what an intelligent designer would do assumes that he knows, and my response is, well, I don't know how to design living things, and why should I presume to understand how a designer would do it?
True enough.
Second, let's think about what good design means. Does it mean that the designed thing never breaks down? We know from our experience with the things we design, take for example a 1940 Cadillac, the top of the line, that Cadillac, if it were still around today, and some of them are, would have had to be refurbished multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
It would need new seats because the leather would have cracked.
Right.
It would need new brakes, new tires, new paint job, I've already said. You get the idea that we should be more durable than a Cadillac.
Right.
When in fact, we do well because when we're older than a Cadillac, we're still running around without replacement parts.
Exactly.
The next thing I would say is that good design doesn't necessarily mean optimal design for all things, because design often means multiple constraints. He actually acknowledges that in his paper, that design has to take into account lots of different factors, and you can't be perfectly designed for one feature because it often goes against what you need for a second feature.
Mm.
The example I give is from airplane technology. Airplanes have to have design features that match a lot of different constraints. They have to be light so they can fly, but they have to be strong so that they can withstand the kinds of stresses they undergo.
Right.
They have to be able to keep people warm and keep it from being too loud, but that all adds weight. They have to be able to keep the atmosphere in the plane breathable. That also adds weight. All of those things have conflicting needs, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if you have to, say, for example, build an airplane that can fly around the world without refueling or stopping anywhere? Well, you're going to have to make the airplane lighter,
mm-hmm.
change that constraint in one direction. You're going to have to get rid of things like insulation and soundproofing to make it lighter.
Right.
You're going to have to change the wing shape
mm-hmm.
to give more lift. You're going to have to take out things like atmospheric controls and fly lower. All these sorts of things mean that the airplane is going to look a lot different than the standard airplane we think about. And someone did build an airplane like that. It's called the Rutan Voyager. And I don't know if you remember. Do you remember that airplane?
Well, unfortunately, I don't.
It was built in 1986. So I was old enough to remember it at the time. It made a flight around the world without stopping or refueling because they made exactly those trade-offs. May have not have been the most comfortable thing to ride in, but at least it got all the way around the world, which is a very special design.
Mm-hmm. Similar to our own design.
Similar to our own design. Let me give you some examples of how we are, in many ways, perfect. He questions why our retina is built the way it is, but I should also say our rod cells in our eyes, the ones that detect black and white light, can detect as little as one photon of light. A photon is the smallest particle of light. That's as small as you can get.
Well, I'm guessing there's nothing in man-made devices that can do that.
You would think that we wouldn't need rod cells quite so sensitive,
mm-hmm.
but yet they are. And you only need about 9 photons to strike your retina, and your brain gets the signal.
Uh-huh.
So even though our eyes aren't as good as, say, a cat's or a dog's, they're still plenty sensitive
mm-hmm.
in the dark. Second way, our language. The tongue, the lips, the technology, if you want to call it that, that allows us to speak, and our hearing are perfectly fit for communication. The way our brain processes language, all of that makes, as Noam Chomsky, who is a very famous linguist, said, it makes our language an optimal way to link sound and meaning. An optimal way, something that's so important to us, and it is perfectly designed.
Great example.
There's also a funny thing. Did you know that a horse and rider can sometimes be bested in a race by a human being over long distances?
I didn't. I read that and I was aghast.
There is a race that's run every year, and I think it's in England, but I'm not sure, where they have a race with human long-distance runners and horses and riders. And I think they go about the length of a standard marathon, 23 miles.
Hmm.
Now, most of the time the horses win, but it has happened that a human being has beat the horses, which is remarkable.
That is a good design.
It's a very good design, especially when you consider that Barash thinks that our feet are not well designed and our pelvises. Well, they obviously are well designed for running.
Mm-hmm. And everything else I do in my day.
Yep. We do get bunions and we do get fallen arches, but that comes with time. We're not born with them.
True.
We wear out. It does happen. Okay, let me just go over a few more things that he said that I find funny. Talking about our brains and our short guts, It's because we need to have high-energy foods, things like proteins, that, say, a cow or a horse don't eat. They eat things like grass, hay, oats, that are difficult to digest, and you have to eat a lot of them to get the energy you need. Okay. So they have long, complicated digestive systems. We have short digestive systems in comparison because we eat an energy-rich food. We're well-designed, in other words.
A good match, yep.
The fact that we have heads on the top, in the front, the direction we proceed in the world, well, it makes sense. It's a good design because our sense organs go first, and you want to have the sense organs be facing the world so that we can tell what's coming. That's perfectly good design.
And I'll bet you could go on about every one of his examples and deconstruct them. But we don't have to do that today.
Yeah, I could go on a long time.
I'm sure you could. So for us to be able to, and you didn't mention this, but to conceptualize, have this conversation about a topic this deep, doesn't that go way beyond what Darwin's theory could explain by natural selection and survival of the fittest?
Yes, indeed. Why can we think abstractly? That's not something that you need to survive. To survive, you need to be able to gather food and protect yourself from predators and stay warm.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to be able to do astronomical calculations or write symphonies or write poetry. You don't have to be a rocket scientist.
True. So to be fair, you study scientific method. That's what you do. And the infinite workings found within biology. And Dr. Barash is a psychology professor. I'm just wondering, isn't he just out of his realm? And if so, why do you suppose he takes such great pain to comment on this topic when he's not really a scientist in the same way?
Well, when I looked up his CV, curriculum vitae, we call it, same as a resume, it does say that he's an evolutionary biologist. But you're right that his area of competency, where he writes and publishes, has to do with human anthropology, which has to do with how we live, what our societies are like.
Mm-hmm.
He's written other books on the origin of humans and how we develop.
All right. Fair enough. Well, I want to come back and remind people that your writings are available, and they're all fascinating, easy to read, short, which is nice, and usable eminently right there on the spot. I also like, if you go on YouTube, there are segments from Metamorphosis, and I would recommend people get their hands on that. Is there anything you'd like to reveal about projects or research you're working on right now, or...
We just published a paper. You can go to a journal called Biocomplexity. That's bio-complexity on the web, and you can look up our research papers and the papers by other people for those who are scientifically inclined.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly right now, I'm writing for Evolution News and Views and other publications like the one you mentioned at the beginning.
Right. Well, it's a good place for you, and I really enjoy it. And I hope we get to speak again. I enjoy your work, and I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. For ID the Future, this is Todd Butterfield. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.